Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we continue our journey to Winesburg, Ohio, with the next three stories in the book: The Philosopher, Nobody Knows, and Godliness, A Tale in Four Parts, Part 1. It is said the stories of Winesburg, Ohio can be challenging. They have a rambling, episodic quality. There is less focus on plot and more exploration of human nature and the problems of these characters. As we get further into the book, we meet more and more of the characters who live in Winesburg. Anderson gives us such a brutal look at life at the end of the 1800s. And yet, it seems things never really change, do they? And now, The Philosopher, concerning Dr. Parcival. Dr. Parcival was a large man with a drooping mouth covered by a yellow mustache. He always wore a dirty waistcoat, out of the pockets of which protruded a number of the kind of black cigars known as stogies. His teeth were black and irregular, and there was something strange about his eyes. The lid of the left eye twitched. It fell down and snapped up. It was exactly as though the lid of the eye were a window shade, and someone stood inside the doctor's head, playing with the cord. Dr. Parcival had a liking for the boy George Willard. It began when George had been working for a year on the Winesburg Eagle, and the acquaintanceship was entirely a matter of the doctor's own making. In the late afternoon, Will Henderson, owner and editor of the Eagle, went over to Tom Willie's saloon. Along an alleyway, he went, and slipping in at the back door of the saloon, began drinking a drink made of a combination of slow gin and soda water. Will Henderson was a sensualist and had reached the age of 45. He imagined the gin renewed the youth in him. Like most sensualists, he enjoyed talking of women, and for an hour he lingered about, gossiping with Tom Willie. The saloon keeper was a short, broad-shouldered man with peculiarly marked hands, that flaming kind of birthmark that sometimes paints with red the faces of men and women, had touched with red Tom Willie's fingers and the backs of his hands. As he stood by the bar talking to Will Henderson, he rubbed the hands together. As he grew more and more excited, the red of his fingers deepened. It was as though the hands had been dipped in blood that had dried and faded. As Will Henderson stood at the bar looking at the red hands and talking of women, his assistant, George Willard, sat in the office of the Winesburg Eagle and listened to the talk of Dr. Parcival. Dr. Parcival appeared immediately after Will Henderson had disappeared. One might have supposed that the doctor had been watching from his office window and had seen the editor going along the alleyway. Coming in at the front door and finding himself a chair, he lighted one of the stogies and, crossing his legs, began to talk. He seemed intent upon convincing the boy of the advisability of adopting a line of conduct that he himself was unable to define.
"If you have your eyes open, you will see that although I call myself a doctor, I have mighty few patients," he began. "There's a reason for that. It's not an accident, and it is not because I do not know as much of medicine as anyone here. I do not want patients. The reason, you see, does not appear on the surface. It lies in the fact of my character, which has, if you think about it, many strange turns. Why I want to talk to you of the matter, I don't know. I might keep still and get more credit in your eyes. I have a desire to make you admire me, that's a fact. I don't know why. That's why I talk. It's very amusing, eh?"
Sometimes the doctor launched into long tales concerning himself. To the boy, the tales were very real and full of meaning. He began to admire the fat, unclean-looking man, and in the afternoon, when Will Henderson had gone, looked forward with keen interest to the doctor's coming. Dr. Parsifal had been in Winesburg about 5 years. He came from Chicago, and when he arrived, was drunk and got into a fight with Albert Longworth, the baggage man. The fight concerned a trunk and ended by the doctors being escorted to the village lockup. When he was released, he rented a room above a shoe repairing shop at the lower end of Main Street and put out the sign that announced himself as a doctor. Although he had but few patients, and these of the poorer sort, who were unable to pay, he seemed to have plenty of money for his needs. He slept in the office that was unspeakably dirty and dined at Biff Carter's lunchroom in a small frame building opposite the railroad station. In the summer, the lunchroom was filled with flies, and Bill Carter's white apron was more dirty than his floor. Dr. Parsifal did not mind. Into the lunchroom he stalked and deposited 20 cents upon the counter.
"Feed me what you wish for that," he said, laughing. "Use up food that you wouldn't otherwise sell. Makes no difference to me. I am a man of distinction, you see. Why should I concern myself with what I eat?"
The tales that Dr. Parsifal told George Willard began nowhere and ended nowhere. Sometimes the boy thought they must all be inventions, a pack of lies. And then again, he was convinced that they contained the very essence of truth.
"I was a reporter like you here," Dr. Parsifal began. "It was in a town in Iowa, or was it in Illinois? I don't remember, and anyway, it makes no difference. Perhaps I'm trying to conceal my identity and don't want to be very definite. Have you ever thought it strange that I have money for my needs, although I do nothing? I may have stolen a great sum of money or been involved in a murder before I came here. There's food for thought in that, eh? If you were a really smart newspaper reporter, you would look me up. In Chicago, there was a Dr. Cronin who was murdered. Have you heard of that? Some men murdered him and put him in a trunk. In the early morning, they hauled the trunk across the city. It sat on the back of an express wagon, and they were on the seat as unconcerned as anything. Along they went through quiet streets where everyone was asleep. The sun was just coming up over the lake. Funny, eh? Just to think of them smoking pipes and chattering as they drove along as unconcerned as I am now. Perhaps I was one of those men. That would be a strange turn of things. Now, wouldn't it, eh?"
Again, Dr. Parsifal began his tale.
"Well, anyway, there I was, a reporter on a paper just as you are here, running about and getting little items to print. My mother was poor. She took in washing. Her dream was to make me a Presbyterian minister, and I was studying with that end in view. My father had been insane for a number of years. He was in an asylum over in Dayton, Ohio. Well, there you see, I've let it slip out. All of this took place in Ohio, right here in Ohio. There is a clue if you ever get the notion of looking me up. I was going to tell you of my brother. That's the object of all this. That's what I'm getting at. My brother was a railroad painter and had a job on the Big Four. You know, that road runs through Ohio here. With other men, he lived in a boxcar, and away he went from town to town painting the railroad property switches, cross gates, bridges, and stations. The Big Four paints its stations a nasty orange color. How I hate that color! My brother was always covered with it. On paydays, he used to get drunk and come home wearing his paint-covered clothes and bringing his money with him. He did not give it to Mother, but laid it in a pile on our kitchen table. About the house he went and the clothes covered with the nasty orange-colored paint. I can see the picture. My mother, who was small and had red, sad-looking eyes, would come into the house from a little shed at the back. It's where she spent her time, over the washtub, scrubbing people's dirty clothes. In she would come and stand by the table, rubbing her eyes with her apron that was covered with soap suds. "Don't touch it! Don't you dare touch that money!" my brother roared. And then he himself took $5 or $10 and went tramping off to the saloons. When he had spent what he had taken, he came back for more. He never gave my mother any money at all, but stayed about until he had spent it all, a little at a time. Then he went back to his job with the painting crew on the railroad. After he had gone, things began to arrive at our house, groceries and such. Sometimes there would be a dress for Mother, or a pair of shoes for me. Strange, eh? My mother loved my brother much more than she did me. Although he never said a kind word to either of us, and always raved up and down, threatening us if we dared so much as touch the money that sometimes lay on the table 3 days. We got along pretty well. I studied to be a minister and prayed. I was a regular ass about saying prayers. You should have heard me. When my father died, I prayed all night, just as I did sometimes when my brother was in town, drinking and going about buying the things for us. In the evening after supper, I knelt by the table where the money lay and prayed for hours. When no one was looking, I stole a dollar or two and put it in my pocket. Makes me laugh now, but then it was terrible. It was on my mind all the time. I got $6 a week from a job on the paper, and always took it straight home to Mother. The few dollars I stole from my brother's pile I spent on myself, you know, for trifles, candy and cigarettes and such things. When my father died at the asylum over in Dayton, I went over there. I borrowed some money from the man for whom I worked and went on the train at night. It was raining. In the asylum, they treated me as though I were a king. The men who had jobs in the asylum had found out I was a newspaper reporter, and that made them afraid. There had been some negligence, some carelessness, you see, when Father was ill. They thought perhaps I would write it up in the paper and make a fuss. I never intended to do anything of the kind. Anyway, in I went to the room where my father lay dead and blessed his dead body. I wonder what put that notion into my head. Wouldn't my brother the painter have laughed, though? There I stood over the dead body and spread out my hands. The superintendent of the asylum and some of his helpers came in and stood about, looking sheepish. It was very amusing. I spread my hands out and said, "Let peace brood over this carcass." That's what I said. Jumping to his feet and breaking off the tale, Dr. Parsifal began to walk up and down in the office of the Winesburg Eagle, where George Willard sat listening. He was awkward, and as the office was small, continually knocked against things.
"What a fool I am to be talking," he said. "That is not my object in coming here and forcing my acquaintanceship upon you. I have something else in mind. You are a reporter, just as I was once, and you have attracted my attention. You may end up by becoming just such another fool. I want to warn you and keep on warning you. That's why I seek you out."
Dr. Parsifal began talking of George Willard's attitude toward men. It seemed to the boy that the man had but one object in view, to make everyone seem despicable.
"I want to fill you with hatred and contempt so that you will be a superior being," he declared. "Look at my brother. There was a fella, eh? He despised everyone, you see. You have no idea with what contempt he looked upon Mother and me. And was he not our superior? You know he was. You have not seen him, and yet I have made you feel that. I have given you a sense of it. He is dead. Once when he was drunk,
He lay down on the tracks, and the car in which he lived with the other painters ran over him.
One day in August, Dr. Parcival had an adventure in Winesburg. For a month, George Willard had been going each morning to spend an hour in the doctor's office. The visits came about through a desire on the part of the doctor to read to the boy from the pages of a book he was in the process of writing. To write the book, Dr. Parcival declared, was the object of his coming to Winesburg to live. On the morning in August, before the coming of the boy, an incident had happened in the doctor's office. There had been an accident on Main Street. A team of horses had been frightened by a train and had run away. A little girl, the daughter of a farmer, had been thrown from a buggy and killed. On Main Street, everyone had become excited, and a cry for doctors had gone up. All three of the active practitioners of the town had come quickly, but had found the child dead. From the crowd, someone had run to the office of Dr. Parcival, who had bluntly refused to go down out of his office to the dead child. The useless cruelty of his refusal had passed unnoticed. Indeed, the man who had come up the stairs to summon him had hurried away without hearing the refusal. All of this Dr. Parcival did not know, and when George Willard came to his office, he found the man shaking with terror.
"What I have done will arouse the people of this town," he declared excitedly. "Do I not know human nature? Do I not know what will happen? Word of my refusal will be whispered about. Presently, men will get together in groups and talk of it. They will come here, we will quarrel, and there will be talk of hanging. Then they will come again, bearing a rope in their hands."
Dr. Parcival shook with fright.
"I have a presentiment," he declared emphatically. "It may be that what I'm talking about will not occur this morning. It may be put off until tonight. But I will be hanged. Everyone will get excited. I will be hanged to a lamppost on Main Street."
Going to the door of his dirty office, Dr. Parcival looked timidly down the stairway leading to the street. When he returned, the fright that had been in his eyes was beginning to be replaced by doubt. Coming up on tiptoe across the room, he tapped George Willard on the shoulder.
"If not now, sometime," he whispered, shaking his head. "In the end, I will be crucified, uselessly crucified."
Dr. Parcival began to plead with George Willard.
"You must pay attention to me,"
he urged.
"If something happens, perhaps you will be able to write the book that I may never get written. The idea is very simple, so simple that if you are not careful, you will forget it. It is this, that everyone in the world is Christ, and they are all crucified. That's what I want to say. Don't you forget that. Whatever happens, don't you dare let yourself forget."
Nobody knows. Concerning Louise Trunnion. Looking cautiously about, George Willard arose from his desk in the office of the Winesburg Eagle and went hurriedly out at the back door. The night was warm and cloudy, and although it was not yet 8 o'clock, the alleyway back of the Eagle office was pitch dark. A team of horses tied to a post somewhere in the darkness stamped on the hard-baked ground. A cat sprung from under George Willard's feet and ran away into the night. The young man was nervous. All day he had gone about his work like one dazed by a blow. In the alleyway, he trembled as though with fright. In the darkness, George Willard walked along the alleyway, going carefully and cautiously. The back doors of the Winesburg stores were open, and he could see men sitting about under the store lamps. In Meyerbaum's Notion store, Mrs. Willie, the saloon keeper's wife, stood by the counter with a basket on her arm. Sid Green, the clerk, was waiting on her. He leaned over the counter and talked earnestly. George Willard crouched and then jumped through the path of light that came out at the door. He began to run forward in the darkness. Behind Ed Griffith's saloon, old Jerry Bird, the town drunkard, lay asleep on the ground. The runner stumbled over the sprawling legs. He laughed brokenly. George Willard set forth upon an adventure. All day he had been trying to make up his mind to go through with the adventure, and now he was acting. In the office of the Winesburg Eagle, he had been sitting since 6 o'clock, trying to think. There had been no decision. He had just jumped to his feet, hurried past Will Henderson, who was reading proof in the printer shop, and started to run along the alleyway. Through street after street went George Willard, avoiding the people who passed. He crossed and recrossed the road. When he passed a street lamp, he pulled his hat down over his face. He did not dare think. In his mind there was a fear, but it was a new kind of fear. He was afraid the adventure on which he had set out would be spoiled, that he would lose courage and turn back. George Willard found Louise Trunnion in the kitchen of her father's house. She was washing dishes by the light of a kerosene lamp. There she stood, behind the screen door, in the little shed-like kitchen at the back of the house. George Willard stopped by a picket fence and tried to control the shaking of his body. Only a narrow potato patch separated him from the adventure. 5 minutes passed before he felt sure enough of himself to call to her. "Louise! Oh, Louise!" he called. The cry stuck in his throat. His voice became a hoarse whisper. Louise Trunnion came out across the potato patch, holding the dishcloth in her hand.
"How do you know I want to go out with you?" she said sulkily. "What makes you so sure?"
George Willard did not answer. In silence, the two stood in the darkness with the fence between them.
"You go on along," she said. "Pause in there. I'll come along. You wait by William's barn."
The young newspaper reporter had received a letter from Louise Trunnion. It had come that morning to the office of the Winesburg Eagle. The letter was brief. "I'm yours if you want me," it said. He thought it annoying that in the darkness by the fence, she had pretended there was nothing between them.
"She has a nerve. Well, gracious sakes, she has a nerve," he muttered as he went along the street and passed a row of vacant lots where corn grew.
The corn was shoulder high and had been planted right down to the sidewalk. When Louise Trunnion came out of the front door of her house, she still wore the gingham dress in which she had been washing dishes. There was no hat on her head. The boy could see her, standing with the doorknob in her hand, talking to someone within, no doubt to old Jake Trunnion, her father. Old Jake was half deaf, and she shouted. The door closed, and everything was dark and silent in the little side street. George Willard trembled more violently than ever. In the shadows by William's barn, George and Louise stood, not daring to talk. She was not particularly comely, and there was a black smudge on the side of her nose. George thought she must have rubbed her nose with her finger after she'd been handling some of the kitchen pots. The young man began to laugh nervously.
"It's warm," he said.
He wanted to touch her with his hand.
"I'm not very bold," he thought.
Just to touch the folds of the soiled gingham dress would, he decided, be an exquisite pleasure. She began to quibble.
"You think you're better than I am? Don't tell me. I guess I know," she said, drawing closer to him.
A flood of words burst from George Willard. He remembered the look that had lurked in the girl's eyes when they had met on the streets, and thought of the note she had written him. Doubt left him. The whispered tales concerning her that had gone about town gave him confidence. He became wholly the male, bold and aggressive. In his heart, there was no sympathy for her.
"Aw, come on. It'll be all right. There won't be anyone know anything. How can they know?" he urged.
They began to walk along a narrow brick sidewalk between the cracks of which tall weeds grew. Some of the bricks were missing, and the sidewalk was rough and irregular. He took hold of her hand that was also rough, and thought it delightfully small. "I can't go far," she said, and her voice was quiet, unperturbed. They crossed a bridge that ran over a tiny stream and passed another vacant lot in which corn grew. The street ended. In the path at the side of the road, they were compelled to walk one behind the other. Will Overton's berry field lay beside the road, and there was a pile of boards.
"Will is going to build a shed to store berry crates here," said George,
and they sat down upon the boards. When George Willard got back into Main Street, it was past 10 o'clock and had begun to rain. 3 times he walked up and down the length of Main Street. Sylvester West's drugstore was still open, and he went in and bought a cigar. When Shorty Crandall, the clerk, came out at the door with him, he was pleased. For 5 minutes, the two stood in the shelter of the store awning and talked. George Willard felt satisfied. He had wanted more than anything else to talk to some man. Around a corner toward the new Willard house, he went whistling softly. On the sidewalk at the side of Winnie's dry goods store, where there was a high board fence covered with circus pictures, he stopped whistling and stood perfectly still in the darkness, attentive, listening, as though for a voice calling his name. Then again he laughed nervously.
"She hasn't got anything on me. Nobody knows,"
he muttered doggedly, and went on his way. Godliness, a Tale in 4 Parts. Part 1. Concerning Jess Bentley. There were always 3 or 4 old people sitting on the front porch of the house or puttering about the garden of the Bentley farm. 3 of the old people were women and sisters to Jess. They were a colorless, soft-voiced lot. Then there was a silent old man with thin white hair who was Jess's uncle. The farmhouse was built of wood, a board outer covering over a framework of logs. It was, in reality, not one house, but a cluster of houses joined together in a rather haphazard manner. Inside, the place was full of surprises. One went up steps from the living room into the dining room, and there were always steps to be ascended or descended in passing from one room to another. At mealtimes, the place was like a beehive. At one moment, all was quiet. Then doors began to open, feet clattered on stairs, a murmur of soft voices arose, and people appeared from a dozen obscure corners. Besides the old people already mentioned, many others lived in the Bentley house. There were 4 hired men, a woman named Aunt Callie Beebe, who was in charge of the housekeeping, a dull-witted girl named Eliza Stratton, who made beds and helped with the milking, a boy who worked in the stables, and Jess Bentley himself, the owner and overlord of it all. By the time the American Civil War had been over for 20 years, that part of northern Ohio where the Bentley farms lay had begun to emerge from pioneer life. Jess then owned machinery for harvesting grain. He had built modern barns, and most of his land was drained with carefully laid tile drain. But in order to understand the man, we will have to go back to an earlier day. The Bentley family had been in northern Ohio for several generations before Jess's time. They came from New York State and took up land when the country was new and land could be had at a low price. For a long time, they, in common with all the other Middle Western people, were very poor. The land they had settled upon was heavily wooded and covered with fallen logs and underbrush. After the long, hard labor of clearing these away and cutting the timber, there were still the stumps to be reckoned with. Plows run through the fields caught on hidden roots. Stones lay all about. On the low places, water gathered, and the young corn turned yellow, sickened, and died. When Jess Bentley's father and brothers had come into their ownership of the place, much of the harder part of the work of clearing had been done. But they clung to old traditions and worked like driven animals. They lived as practically all of the farming people of the time lived. In the spring and through most of the winter, the highways leading into the town of Winesburg were a sea of mud. The four young men of the family worked hard all day in the fields. They ate heavily, of course, greasy food, and at night slept like tired beasts on beds of straw. Into their lives came little that was not coarse and brutal, and outwardly they were themselves coarse and brutal. On Saturday afternoons, they hitched a team of horses to a three-seated wagon and went off into town. In town, they stood about the stoves in the stores, talking to other farmers or to the storekeepers. They were dressed in overalls, and in the winter wore heavy coats that were flecked with mud. Their hands, as they stretched them out to the heat of the stoves, were cracked and red. It was difficult for them to talk, and so they, for the most part, kept silent. When they had bought meat, flour, sugar, and salt, they went into one of Winesburg's saloons and drank beer. Under the influence of drink, the naturally strong lusts of their natures, kept suppressed by the heroic labor of breaking up new ground, were released. A kind of crude and animal-like poetic fervor took possession of them. On the road home, they stood up on the wagon seats and shouted at the stars. Sometimes they fought, long and bitterly, and at other times they broke forth into songs. Once, Enoch Bentley, the older one of the boys, struck his father, old Tom Bentley, with the butt of a teamster's whip, and the old man seemed likely to die. For days, Enoch lay hid in the straw in the loft of the stable, ready to flee if the result of his momentary passion turned out to be murder. He was kept alive with food brought by his mother, who also kept him informed of the injured man's condition. When all turned out well, he emerged from his hiding place and went back to the work of clearing land, as though nothing had happened. The Civil War brought a sharp turn to the fortunes of the Bentleys and was responsible for the rise of the youngest son, Jess. Enoch, Edward, Harry, and Will Bentley all enlisted, and before the long war ended, they were all killed. For a time, after they went away to the South, old Tom tried to run the place, but he was not successful. When the last of the four had been killed, he sent word to Jess that he would have to come home. Then the mother, who had not been well for a year, died suddenly, and the father became altogether discouraged. He talked of selling the farm and moving into town. All day he went about shaking his head and muttering. The work in the fields was neglected, and weeds grew high in the corn. Old Tim hired men, but he didn't use them intelligently. When they had gone away to the fields in the morning, he wandered into the woods and sat on a log. Sometimes he forgot to come home at night, and one of the daughters had to go in search of him. When Jess Bentley came home to the farm and began to take charge of things, he was a slight, sensitive-looking man of 22. At 18, he had left home to go to school to become a scholar, and eventually to become a minister of the Presbyterian Church. All through his boyhood, he had been what in our country was called an odd sheep, and had not got on with his brothers. Of all the family, only his mother had understood him, and she was now dead. When he came home to take charge of the farm, that had at that time grown to more than 600 acres, everyone on the farms about and in the nearby town of Winesburg smiled at the idea of his trying to handle the work that had been done by his four strong brothers. There was indeed good cause to smile. By the standards of his day, Jess did not look like a man at all. He was small and very slender and womanish of body, and true to the traditions of young ministers, wore a long black coat and a narrow black string tie. The neighbors were amused when they saw him, after the years away, and they were even more amused when they saw the woman he had married in the city. As a matter of fact, Jess's wife did soon go under. That was perhaps Jess's fault. A farm in northern Ohio in the hard years after the Civil War was no place for a delicate woman, and Catherine Bentley was delicate. Jess was hard with her, as he was with everybody about him in those days. She tried to do such work as all the neighbor women about her did, and he let her go on without interference. She helped to do the milking and did part of the housework. She made the beds for the men and prepared their food. For a year she worked every day, from sunrise until late at night. And then, after giving birth to a child, she died. As for Jess Bentley, although he was a delicately built man, there was something within him that could not easily be killed. He had brown curly hair and gray eyes that were at times hard and direct, at times wavering and uncertain. Not only was he slender, but he was also short of stature. His mouth was like the mouth of a sensitive and very determined child. Jess Bentley was a fanatic. He was a man born out of his time and place, and for this he suffered and made others suffer. Never did he succeed in getting what he wanted out of life, and he did not know what he wanted. Within a very short time after he came home to the Bentley farm, he made everyone there a little afraid of him, and his wife, who should have been close to him as his mother had been, was afraid also. At the end of 2 weeks after his coming, old Tom Bentley made over to him the entire ownership of the place and retired into the background. Everyone retired into the background. In spite of his youth and inexperience, Jess had the trick of mastering the souls of his people. He was so in earnest in everything he did and said that no one understood him. He made everyone on the farm work as they had never worked before, and yet there was no joy in the work. If things went well, they went well for Jess, and never for the people who were his dependents. Like 1,000 other strong men who have come into the world here in America in these later times, Jess was but half strong. He could master others, but he could not master himself. The running of the farm, as it had never been run before, was easy for him. When he came home from Cleveland, where he had been in school, he shut himself off from all of his people and began to make plans. He thought about the farm, night and day, and that made him successful. Other men on the farms about him worked too hard and were too tired to think. But to think of the farm and to be everlastingly making plans for its success was a relief to Jess. It partially satisfied something in his passionate nature. Immediately after he came home, he had a wing built onto the old house, and in a large room facing the west, he had windows that looked into the barnyard and other windows that looked off across the fields. By the window, he sat down to think. Hour after hour, and day after day, he sat and looked over the land and thought about his new place in life. The passionate burning thing in his nature flamed up, and his eyes became hard. He wanted to make the farm produce as no farm in his state had ever produced before, and then he wanted something else. It was the indefinable hunger within that made his eyes waver and that kept him always more and more silent before people. He would have given much to achieve peace, and in him was a fear that peace was the thing he could not achieve. All over his body, Jess Bentley was alive. In his small frame was gathered the force of a long line of strong men. He had always been extraordinarily alive when he was a small boy on the farm, and later when he was a young man in school. In the school, he had studied and thought of God and the Bible with his whole mind and heart. As time passed, and he grew to know people better, he began to think of himself as an extraordinary man, one set apart from his fellows. He wanted terribly to make his life a thing of great importance. And as he looked about at his fellow men and saw how like clods they lived, it seemed to him that he could not bear to become also such a clod. Although in his absorption in himself, and in his own destiny, he was blind to the fact that his young wife was doing a strong woman's work even after she had become large with child, and that she was killing herself in his service. He did not intend to be unkind to her. When his father, who was old and twisted with toil, made over to him the ownership of the farm and seemed content to creep away to a corner and wait for death, he shrugged his shoulders and dismissed the old man from his mind. In the room by the window, overlooking the land that had come down to him, sat Jess, thinking of his own affairs. In the stables, he could hear the tramping of his horses and the restless movement of his cattle. Away in the fields, he could see other cattle wandering over green hills. The voices of men, his men who worked for him, came in to him through the window. From the milk house, there was the steady thump, thump of a churn being manipulated by the half-witted girl, Eliza Stratton. Jess's mind went back to the men of Old Testament days who had also owned lands and herds. He remembered how God had come down out of the skies and talked to these men, and he wanted God to notice and to talk to him also. A kind of feverish, boyish eagerness to in some way achieve in his own life the flavor of significance that had hung over these men took possession of him. Being a prayerful man, he spoke of the matter aloud to God, and the sound of his own words strengthened and fed his eagerness. "I am a new kind of man come into possession of these fields," he declared. "Look upon me, O God, and look thou also upon my neighbors and all the men who have gone before me here. O God, create in me another Jess, like that one of old, to rule over men and to be the father of sons who shall be rulers." Jess grew excited as he talked aloud and, jumping to his feet, walked up and down in the room. In fancy, he saw himself living in old times and among old peoples. The land that lay stretched out before him became of vast significance, a place peopled by his fancy with a new race of men sprung from himself. It seemed to him that in his day, as in those other and older days, kingdoms might be created and new impulses given to the lives of men by the power of God speaking through a chosen servant. He longed to be such a servant. "It is God's work I have come to the land to do," he declared in a loud voice, and his short figure straightened, and he thought that something like a halo of godly approval hung over him. It will perhaps be somewhat difficult for the men and women of a later day to understand Jess Bentley. In the last 50 years, a vast change has taken place in the lives of our people. A revolution has in fact taken place. The coming of industrialism, attended by all the roar and rattle of affairs, the shrill cries of millions of new voices that have come among us from overseas, the going and coming of trains, the growth of cities, the building of the interurban car lines that weave in and out of towns and past farmhouses. And now, in these later days, the coming of the automobiles has worked a tremendous change in the lives and in the habits of thought of our people of mid-America. Books, badly imagined, and written though they may be in the hurry of our times, are in every household. Magazines circulate by the millions of copies. Newspapers are everywhere. In our day, a farmer standing by the stove in the store in his village had his mind filled to overflowing with the words of other men. The newspapers and the magazines have pumped him full. Much of the old brutal ignorance that had in it also a kind of beautiful childlike innocence is gone forever. The farmer by the stove is brother to the men of the cities, and if you listen, you will find him talking as glibly and as senselessly as the best city man of us all. In Jess Bentley's time, and in the country districts of the whole Middle West in the years after the Civil War, it was not so. Men labored too hard and were too tired to read. In them was no desire for words printed upon paper. As they worked in the fields, vague, half-formed thoughts took possession of them. They believed in God and in God's power to control their lives. In the little Protestant churches, they gathered on Sunday to hear of God and his works. The churches were the center of the social and intellectual life of the times. The figure of God was big in the hearts of men. And so, having been born an imaginative child, and having within him a great intellectual eagerness, Jess Bentley had turned wholeheartedly toward God. When the war took his brothers away, he saw the hand of God in that. When his father became ill and could no longer attend to the running of the farm, he took that also as a sign from God. In the city, when the word came to him, he walked about at night, through the streets, thinking of the matter, and when he had come home and had got the work of the farm well under way, he went again at night to walk through the forests and over the low hills, and to think of God. As he walked, the importance of his own figure in some divine plan grew in his mind. He grew avaricious, and was impatient that the farm contained only 600 acres. Kneeling in a fence corner at the edge of some meadow, he sent his voice abroad into the silence, and looking up, he saw the stars shining down at him. One evening, some months after his father's death, and when his wife Catherine was expecting at any moment to be laid abed of childbirth, Jess left his house and went for a long walk. The Bentley farm was situated in a tiny valley watered by Wine Creek, and Jess walked along the banks of the stream to the end of his own land and on through the fields of his neighbors. As he walked, the valley broadened and then narrowed again. Great open stretches of field and wood lay before him. The moon came out from behind clouds, and climbing a low hill, he sat down to think. Jess thought that as the true servant of God, the entire stretch of country through which he had walked should have come into his possession. He thought of his dead brothers and blamed them that they had not worked harder and achieved more. Before him in the moonlight, the tiny stream ran down over stones, and he began to think of the men of old times, who, like himself, had owned flocks and lands. A fantastic impulse, half fear, half greediness, took possession of Jess Bentley. He remembered how in the old Bible story, the Lord had appeared to that other Jess and told him to send his son David to where Saul and the men of Israel were fighting the Philistines in the Valley of Elah. Into Jess's mind came the conviction that all of the Ohio farmers who owned land in the valley of Wine Creek were Philistines and enemies of God. Suppose, he whispered to himself, there should come from among them one who, like Goliath, the Philistine of Gath, could defeat me and take from me my possessions. In fancy, he felt the sickening dread that he thought must have lain heavy on the heart of Saul before the coming of David. Jumping to his feet, he began to run through the night. As he ran, he called to God. His voice carried far over the low hills. Jehovah of hosts, he cried, send to me this night out of the womb of Catherine a son. Let thy grace align upon me. Send me a son to be called David, who shall help me to pluck at last all of these lands out of the hands of the Philistines, and turn them to thy service, and to the building of thy kingdom on earth. And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed The Philosopher, Nobody Knows, and Godliness Part 1, from Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwin Anderson. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.